man who needs no introduction and deserves none.
No, 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 no. That's
I'm kidding. Okay. All right. So Neil actually asked me to give a couple of talks, and so I prepared one today that's intended to be very pedagogical, since it's a relatively small audience. Please interrupt if it's not clear. So I'll go through an example or two before getting to the stuff that probably more people are interested in tomorrow on applying this to gravity, the effective theory of gravity, and the predictions of scalar gravitational waves. So let's start. So I'll talk today mostly about the chiral anomaly, which I guess most people are familiar with. Again, if you have questions or there's anything unclear, please ask. And the main points, I mean, so some of this, most of it will be review material. A little bit of it is new, in particular, the connection to hydrodynamics and superfluidity seems to be new. But I will review basic ideas about the anomaly in QED first, even in two dimensions, where you can basically do the calculations, you know, on a piece of paper while you're sitting there. So it should be easy to follow, I hope. And the main thing which I want to emphasize in this first seminar today is the presence and the appearance of massless poles, massless scalar poles and anomaly amplitudes. This seems to be a general feature of anomalies, and both of the chiral anomaly, and will carry over to the conformal anomaly and the applications tomorrow. So let's start with the very basic thing that if you have a classical Lagrangian, let's just say schematically a function of fields and their derivatives, then the variation is this, but by flipping the derivative onto this term and using the Euler-Lagrange equations, this term is zero. And so if you have a special symmetry, a symmetry of the Lagrangian under which Lagrangian is invariant, the left side is zero, and that implies that there must be a conserved current. This is, of course, know this theorem. So the issue is, what is an anomaly, first of all? It's when there is some conflict between this very simple and general classical consideration and an obstruction, if you wish, in the quantum theory to actually having a conserved current. And the reason, of course, comes back to the fact that currents in quantum field theory are local operators, local distributions, which require some notion of regularization or renormalization to even be defined. And in that procedure, you may end up with some obstruction. And typically, it's an obstruction between different conservation laws that you're trying to maintain simultaneously. So that's a general definition. A case that is very important physically and historically played a very important role in QCD is the fact that in QCD with massless quarks or almost massless quarks, you have an apparent symmetry under flavor rotations, unitary flavor rotations in n flavors, and chiral rotations in the gamma 5 chiral space. But the U1 chiral symmetry is anomalous. And this has very important low energy effects, which is in textbooks and everybody I think knows, is that the effect of Lagrangian is in the chiral limit does not have the full complement of NF squared massless bosons, massless pions at low energies, but one less. So if the two flavors up and down quarks, you might expect naively to have four pseudo-Goldstone bosons, but you only have the three pions, and the U1 singlet part is not almost massless. And that also has a consequence that the neutral pion decays to two photons through the triangle amplitude. We'll talk about this in detail. And this is the anomalous factor on the right-hand side, which is finite, well-determined. And this leads to a pi to 2 gamma coupling, which is actually confirmed in QCD because it depends on the number of colors running around this loop and their representations in the group. And this verifies the fractional charges of the quarks running around the loop, because otherwise the coefficient doesn't match. So this is just, you know, a lightning introduction, but just to indicate from the very beginning that there are effects associated with anomalies. So, you know, in gravity, where we're going to get to, people often say quantum effects are small or irrelevant. Well, here's an example where a rather subtle quantum effect, this anomaly, leads to definite low energy predictions for the Pinot decay constant. And the technical issue is that although there's no local action that you can write expressed completely in terms of the gauge fields, there is a non-local infrared relevant operator that effectively violates the decoupling of the ultraviolet to the infrared. So that's the important message that's going to be running through these two talks, is that you start perhaps with some microscopic or ultraviolet degrees of freedom. Here you treat these quarks perturbatively, and you calculate this anomaly based on the representations of the quarks. Nevertheless, you apply this to low energy physics and the Pinot decay. Of course, this is highly non-trivial, right? Because this is it's a confining theory. There are no free quarks running around in the asymptotic states. Nevertheless, one can take the UV theory, the short distance physics of the perturbative QCD, match the anomaly coefficient to the infrared in an effective theory with the pions, for example, and get the correct decay rate. So it's an example. I think this is not always emphasized, and that's what it's going to be the emphasis of my talk, that an anomaly is, if you wish, a loophole or a particular way in which ultraviolet physics can leak down into the infrared and change the symmetries of the theory. So that's going to be the general theme here. So let's do an example in order to keep all the ideas definite and show everything explicitly. So let's take two dimensions, and let's take an abelian theory, just QED, and we'll worry about adding the gauge field term later, but it's just massless fermions coupled to a background gauge field. So at the level of the classical action, you have two symmetries. You have the ordinary gauge symmetry, U1 rotation, if I make a gauge transformation on the gauge potential. And this leads to the familiar Noether current of charge conservation is conserved if this is a symmetry of the action. However, if the mass of the fermions is zero, I have a second U1 chiral rotation, in which is a gamma 5 appearing up here. And there's a dual potential, which is related to the ordinary potential just by the antisymmetric epsilon symbol, which is 0, 1. So it's just the antisymmetric symbol in 2D, which is plus 1 if this is 0 and 1, minus 1 if this is 1 and 0, and 0 otherwise. So there's a dual potential, and in fact, I can describe any gauge field in two dimensions in terms of two potentials, the gauge prepotentials, if you wish, the gradient of the scalar part and the gradient of the chiral part, which appears in the dual field representation. And this leads, by Noether's theorem, which we just started reviewing, to a chiral current, in which there's a gamma 5 inside here. So it counts the left-moving and right-moving fermions on the one-dimensional line with opposite signs. That's the chiral charge operator. Gamma 5, in somewhat abusive notation, is really gamma 3 here. It's just the product of the two gamma matrices, gamma 0 and gamma 1, which I can write that way. So you would expect both currents to be conserved, according to Noether's theorem. However, as soon as you calculate the first simplest one-loop diagram, in which you have a chiral current here and a vector current there, which I represent this way. It's basically an epsilon on the ordinary vacuum polarization. This would imply, if both of these currents are conserved, this would imply that if I contract with K mu or contract with K nu, that both of these should be zero on this amplitude. That would be the quantum version of the Ward identity following from Noether's theorem. So both of these should vanish. But you can easily convince yourself that that's impossible. And of course, the underlying reason is that loop integral is not really well defined. As it appears, it's log divergent because there's 1 over fermion propagators and you're in 2 dimensions. And so you have to supply some additional information. So usually, of course, in the field theory books, you supply some regularization like polyvelars or dimensional. But that, I think, tends to obscure a little bit what's going on. That does give you the right answer. But what's really going on is that you have a conflict between all the symmetries you want to maintain. What are they? Lorentz invariance, current conservation or gauge invariance, and chiral invariance. All three of those cannot be maintained. So to see what's going on, think about Lorentz invariance first. So I have only one vector, k, and I have epsilon symbol at my disposal, so I can make 3 possible invariants with the right symmetries. However, 2 of them are related to the third. There's only 2 independent ones. This is just a Schutten identity for the epsilon symbol. Easily convince yourself by taking all the values here. So in fact, I can represent this amplitude in terms of only 2 scalar quantities called A and B, which are functions only of K squared. Now, if I contract with K mu on this vertex, then in order for that to vanish, I would have to have the relation that A times K squared is equal to B. Whereas if I contract on K nu, this term is automatically zero because of anti-symmetry, but this term isn't unless I put B equal to zero. So I get 2 conditions which can't be satisfied unless both A and B are zero in general. So that just shows you very, very simple finger counting why there's going to be a problem. So in fact, you must either give up charge current or chiral current conservation or Lorentz invariance. And so naturally, we maintain Lorentz invariance and gauge invariance, and we give up the chiral current conservation, which seems to be a less fundamental symmetry. But we didn't have to. Mathematically, it's an obstruction between these various invariances, and you have to make a choice. That's the mathematical content of the anomaly. Yes?
You could take any linear combinations and say...
That's right, yeah. That's right. I could of course violate more than one symmetry. I could.
What I say when you think which one you preserve, it doesn't have to be one or the other.
That's right. It could be any mixture and violate the other combination. Right. So I think it's good to keep in mind that the anomaly doesn't force you to violate chiral invariance, but it does tell you that you have to, that something has to give. You can't have everything you might want. And in fact, if you look at the cut diagram, just look at the imaginary part by putting these lines on shell, the finite parts of the diagram are finite and non-zero, and you have nothing to do with regularization. And so you can, in fact, determine the full amplitude by the finite parts, a dispersion relation, and demanding all these symmetries. So. How does that work? It's instructive to look at the finite part by putting in a fermion mass. If you put in a fermion mass, I'm going to skip some of the details, but they're very simple. You can calculate the finite imaginary part. And lo and behold, it is proportional to the mass. So it would seem that there isn't going to be an anomaly, right? Because if once I put the mass back to zero, when I do have the chiral symmetry again at the classical level, then the imaginary part vanishes, it would seem, at least for any finite S. There is no anomaly in the imaginary part. In fact, there can't be because it's finite. It has nothing to do with regularization. However, rho obeys an ultraviolet finite sum rule, you can just integrate this over S, and either in the explicit form or in this form, if you integrate the delta function, you get 1. So this is independent of the mass. So this is telling you that something delicate is happening, since for any finite mass, you have an imaginary part. If you take the mass to 0, you naively get 0. Nevertheless, there's a finite sum rule, which is independent of the mass, which tells you you can't really have 0 everywhere. And just look at this form, and you see if I put m to 0, and then I can take the delta function outside. So in fact, what's happening is that this is getting sharper and sharper peaked and produces finally a delta function at s equals 0. And now if you calculate the real part from the imaginary part using the dispersion relation, the delta function at s equals 0 means that this thing goes like 1 over k squared. Okay? Yeah.
So if you don't take s goes to 0, don't take that limit, what then?
I think he's talking.
Well, this is for general s. In other words, this always picks up a contribution at s equals 0 because of the sum rule if I take m to 0.
Just I miss.
Yeah, this should be very simple.
What is which amplitude here?
What?
Which diagram?
This is basically the A.
The A.
Yeah. So one way to do this is you can write down the diagram, the Feynman rules, and pick out the tensor component that's proportional to this, and then that is a scalar quantity, and then you just look at that quantity. Good. So already, as I said, with one or two slides, you already see something very subtle is going on. Namely, this amplitude, which is picking up a contribution only from the very tip of phase space, and that's producing a 1 over k squared pole. And that's, of course, very significant and unusual in perturbation theory, in quantum field theory. When you calculate amplitudes, you typically get very complicated functions, logarithms, cuts, all sorts of analytic structure. And here you get a very simple isolated pole in this limit. So this is very special to the anomaly. So if I now calculate, if I take this quantity and take this choice that I'm going to demand b equals 0 because I want to demand conservation on the ordinary current vertex, b is 0. So I'm stuck with whatever I get here. And I get this value, a, which is going like 1 over k squared, which means if I contract with k mu, I contract here with k mu, that just gives k squared. So it gives me a times k squared. And a times k squared is just 1 over pi. So it gives me a finite non-zero result, which means that the chiral current is not conserved. So that's the anomaly. If I go back from momentum space to position space, the k is, consider this in a background gauge field. So I couple here to an a nu. Then I have a derivative of a nu. And with the epsilon symbol, that's basically giving me this gauge invariant structure. It has to be gauge invariant because I've demanded current conservation on that vertex. And it is this gauge invariant structure, which is just the electric field. This is 0, 1. F0, 1 is basically just the electric field in one dimension. So here is the short derivation of the anomaly. And you already see in two dimensions in this example that you get a 1 over k squared pole. Questions? John, you're not the student. Go ahead. Yeah. What's your question? Sorry.
If you had a field theory where there wasn't a logarithmic divergence, you still have to get this answer.
Yeah.
That's the message.
Yeah. Yeah, because you see,
depends on renormalization.
Yeah, it depends only on demand. It's a clash of invariances. Okay. And the logarithmic divergence is just saying that there's an ambiguity. And so the field theory, you have to give some additional information to tell it which choice to make. But the fundamental situation is that you can't have all the symmetries. And if you demand Lorentz invariance and gauge invariance, you must get a finite answer in the other direction.
Okay.
Yeah, well, there are already questions, good. This is very simple, so we should follow it. Yeah, go ahead.
Why do you only add a mass to the imaginary part, or is it just not relevant?
No, that's a mass to the whole thing.
Oh, okay, sorry.
It's not just to your, I'm just, so I, yeah, I skipped the calculation of the imaginary part.
Okay.
To,
okay.
But if you put a mass in and calculate the imaginary part, this is the result.
Okay. Sorry. Yes.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to fill up the slide with too many equations, but it's a very simple thing to just put a mass term into the Dirac equation. It's a simple one loop diagram. Yeah.
Here you chose B equals zero. What if you make the other choice to keep the other current? Presumably you have the same story.
Yeah, you have this. You have the same story, and then you broke gauge invariance or Lorentz invariance. I mean, it's also possible to mangle the integrals and just don't demand that it's Lorentz invariant.
The story was a pole, and then the anomaly is now.
Yeah, the anomaly is basically, you know, it's whack-a-mole. You push down here, it comes up there, right? It's a fundamental obstruction.
I mean, it's like having a local counter term. I mean.
Yeah.
It's like a local counter term.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it. So, yeah.
I understand it as there is some kind of, maybe you're going to go there, non-commutation relation between, you know, J0 and J05.
Yeah, we're going to get, we'll actually show that, yeah.
And
yeah.
Maybe just a question about the conservation of rho. Like the sum rule you use, maybe you could explain this finite sum rule, what physical meaning is.
Well, it means that, you know, if in condensed matter physics, when you have finite sum rules, it's telling you that you have some degree of freedom that up to some normalization. This is telling you that there's a degree of freedom associated with this anomalous amplitude. That can't be set to zero. So no matter. So basically, if you have a mass, what you have is a resonance, but the integral under the resonance is still the same. So whether you have a stable excitation or an unstable excitation or a resonance, there's still a physical excitation underlying this. This rho is basically a statement of the density of states. So the density of states, the total number of states is fixed, is one.
I just want to make another comment.
Another comment.
The body of a large regularization breaks gauge invariance, Lorentz invariance, and all unitarity.
No, polyvolars.
If you use a regularization which keeps all of the Poincaré, all of it, you still get this result.
Yeah.
I've published this.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay, we talked about it. Yeah.
So, what's the justification for? So, normally the justification I would give for, okay, I have some mass of the particle, I'll give it a mass, would be that at the end of the day, I'll get a continuous answer if I take n goes to zero. So, here you say, okay, I tried this and it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, could have just taken mass zero from the beginning, right? And just done the calculation. I just think it's illustrative to see what's happening if I put in a mass and take it to zero continuously. But
you're saying there's some calculation you haven't shown where you don't do this and you get the same result, or
no. I mean, if I don't do this, I just directly get this answer. I mean, I haven't hidden anything. The only thing I haven't written down is. Which I can write here, is you can write the Feynman parameterization of the whole amplitude this way. I guess there's a 1/π here. So if you just do the gamma matrix algebra and pick out that tensor structure, the scalar amplitude looks like this. So if I just put m to zero, these cancel, and I get 1/k². The imaginary part you get by putting an I epsilon here and taking the delta function.
This is also independent of.
So there's that. That's it. That's all there is to it. So if you want to put the mass to zero to begin with, then you just trivially get 1/π k². Okay. All right.
This is also independent of. Partially concerned, actually, very, very current problem issues. It's independent of that term.
Yes.
PCAC.
Yes. But of course, it plays an important role. I mean, historically, this played a very important role. Okay. How do you turn this off? I don't want to, yeah, okay. All right, so that's always the danger of giving a pedagogical talk. You get stopped in the first slide. That's good, that's good. Let's try it. I mean, it's really not that hard. but you see, that's the arithmetic is not hard, but something interesting is happening here. That's what I'm trying to convince you of. And you can really just pull it apart in perturbation theory. So what does this mean? One way of looking at it also is through an effective action. There's a one loop, one PI effective action corresponding to this diagram. And in fact, this is exact. You can convince yourself that if I had put more interactions on here, this is all an external A field. If I put additional currents, those diagrams are all finite because they're additional propagators. So there's no possible ambiguity, and there's no additional contribution to the anomaly. So everything comes from this one loop diagram.
Hi, sorry, I thought it was 10:30.
I thought you moved it to 10.
No.
That's
Jamie told me 10:30. It's 10:30.
Well, Amanda sent out a message saying 10, and everyone is here at 10. So what can I do? I just work here temporarily. Okay, but you haven't missed much, don't worry. So we're talking about the 2D chiral anomaly. Okay, so in order to write an effective action for this, I say this is an exact answer here, the chiral current the dual of F mu nu, which in two dimensions is a scalar, a pseudoscalar, F tilde, which is just the electric field. And remember, I have this parameterization of the gauge potentials. So the current divergence is actually proportional to the variation of the effective action with respect to this dual parameter beta. And if F tilde, you just calculate F tilde from this A, you have box beta. Okay, so I can obviously integrate this equation trivially. I have a linear dependence on beta, so it means the effective action is just quadratic in beta. So I have an exact effective action. And if I solve for beta by taking d mu of this, that's box beta, I can formally invert that, right? So d mu of the dual potential, the first term vanishes, is box beta. So formally, beta is, I'm just going to, there's only one statement. Yeah, you have to switch it back. So we can just solve for beta and write it in this form. Okay, so you see you can trade basically a local form for this effective action, but in terms of some potential, or I can write it in a fully gauge invariant way, but at the price of making it non-local. Yet I can undo this once again by introducing another field, chi, which is essentially along the direction of beta, and just you can verify if I write this as if I write this action down, then if I vary with respect to chi, I get a linear equation for chi. And if I again play this trick and solve for chi, I get back this effective action. So this is the form. So it's non-local if I write it in the fully gauge invariant way without introducing any new fields. But if I introduce a new field called chi, then I can write it in a local form. So these, again, just very simple very simple manipulations. And this, for those of you who know about bosonization in two dimensions, this is, of course, nothing else but the bosonic current, the bosonic field. The fermion current can now be written in terms of the derivative, the gradient of this chi. And because the electromagnetic current is the dual of this, it can be written this way. And notice what's happened. that the charge density, which is the zero component of this, is proportional to the gradient of chi. So if I include electromagnetism, you know, by putting an F mu nu squared term, I would normally have Gauss's law. And Gauss's law, if I didn't have the anomaly effect, Gauss's law would tell me the electric field is just completely constrained in terms of the charge density. But because I have a field, chi, which is fluctuating, has a kinetic term, therefore, the electric field is forced to follow chi. Gauss's, and the meaning of Gauss's law now is that the electric field, you can trade basically chi or E. One is, if one is fluctuating, then so is the other. So that's how this feeds into electrodynamics. And you asked already, Laurent, about the currents. So since you have this bosonic representation, you can ask yourself in various ways, is this field real? Okay, I did a bunch of tricks, okay, which are formally very simple, but I want to be absolutely 100% sure that this is really a propagating field. And so certainly from the action, I have kinetic terms, it looks like a propagating field. Now I can ask, well, what about its brackets, its canonical commutators? Well, the canonical commutator of chi generates a commutator for the currents through these relations. And this is this relation, namely if I take the zero component of the charge current now, not the chiral current, and the charge density, then I write it in terms of chi. One is the x derivative, one is the time derivative. Take the x derivative out, but chi dot and chi are canonical. It's a canonical pair. One's the momentum of the other, and so this must be just one or h bar if I put in the h bar units. So this is a gradient of a delta function, and this is actually Schwinger's anomalous current commutator. So Schwinger had a completely independent argument that these currents have to have an anomalous commutator, and it shows that is connected with the anomaly in this subtle way. And basically, there's no way to avoid chi being a propagating field with a canonical bracket, because if it didn't have its canonical commutation relations, the current would come out wrong. So there are various ways of looking at this. In a more pedantic or detailed way, if you could go to Fock space, okay, all of these were operator statements, but I could go to Fock space and represent the fermions on a line. I'm in one dimension, and here's just the ordinary representation of the Dirac field in right and left movers, creation destruction operators. I construct the densities normal ordered, and so they're bilinears of these things. And if I normal order them, I get this combination of density of Fock space operators, and obviously they describe some kind of collinear pair. So if I have a fixed index n, which is the Fourier label here, then I have to sum over various fermion q's, which are half integers, and I'm basically summing over some sort of coherent superposition of fermions and antifermions, left and right movers, in order to get the chiral densities. And then you just verify, just a simple algebraic computation, that if I normalize this thing properly, this operator has canonical commutation relations of a boson. So is another way of seeing that the boson field, I construct now the boson field chi in the Fock space, it is a canonically quantized field with the usual commutation relations of a boson, and those follow from the fermion anti-commutation relations. So once again, in a very direct computation, you see that it's completely equivalent, whether you describe this in terms of the original fermions or in terms of this boson pair. So it's not often emphasized, but this is really the relativistic analog of a Cooper pair, which we know in condensed matter of superfluidity and superconductivity. So you have this loop that we started with. If in the intermediate state, there is a fermion and an antifermion pair. Of course, everything's moving collinearly because I'm in one dimension. But that is, by these constructions, exactly equal to a boson. So I could always replace the fermion pair in the loop by a single boson. This is an exact statement. In two dimensions, there's no funny business at all. That was the only point, not to, for you to go through this algebra, but just to see you really can do it. Okay. Any question on this?
Question. Go ahead.
I have a question about some of the zero. I mean, once you are in this chiral boson, you can think about the zero mode of the
zero mode I left out. There's zero mode you have to keep also.
Which are essentially the charges.
That's right.
So the natural question is that the currents do not commute, but I would guess that the two charges do not commute, which is a bit more.
So yes.
There's something non-trivial happening at the zero mode level.
Yes. Yes.
Somehow more than just what you see with the fermion.
Yes, correct. You have to keep all the modes in order to have the full commutation relation, but you cannot treat the zero mode n equals zero the same way, and that's because they're not oscillatory. The solution is linear in t or x, and so that's some kind of a condensate-like mode that you have to treat separately. And it's a whole story.
The Q and QT do not come, even the charges.
I didn't write that down there, but
that might be more subtle too.
Indeed. Then that has to do with topology and the condensate, you know, if you put the theory on a ring. There's lots of interesting stuff here, even in 2D. Okay, but you know, we can't do everything. There was another question?
No, that was the same question.
Okay.
So you said it's exact in two dimensions, so what if we go to four dimensions?
We're going to go to four, I hope, if we get there. Yeah. Okay. So you try to draw some morals here, right? So what's going on? I mean, obviously, this light degree of freedom, which is this massless pole that's propagating in, you know, a physical sense, is relevant, right? Because it propagates on the light cone, and it can have long-distance effects. So no one would say that this quantum effect is irrelevant in a physical sense. And indeed, in a technical sense, this is a relevant, marginally relevant operator in Wilson's classification. So you should keep this term in your low-energy effective action. If you dropped it, you would completely miss a low-energy mode. And here, it turns out you can do the whole calculation from beginning to end. And so there's no doubt you're just changing variables, basically, in the path integral and just giving that an interpretation. But the moral should be that we want to carry over, which comes from QCD and also from this 2D example, is that if you were to try to just expand the effective action in local invariance, you wouldn't think of this mode, right? If I just started I started with this action, I would never imagine that there's some kind of boson field which is propagating at long distances. But yet, from these considerations, there is. And in other words, it doesn't appear in the single particle Dirac spectrum. It's a two-particle collective state. Now, again, depending on your background, this shouldn't be surprising. In condensed matter physics, many body physics, this happens all the time. You start with some fundamental microscopic Lagrangian, but then the system reorganizes itself, and there can be low energy modes that are collective modes that weren't in your single particle Lagrangian. Plasma physics, superfluidity, conductivity are all examples of this. And we're trying to draw that lesson from quantum field theory, and now go to four dimensions. So the point is that massless modes don't decouple, and because of the anomaly, there is some sensitivity. So here's the point. These calculations are simple, and I'm presenting it in a certain way, but this is review material. This could have been done, you know, 30 years ago. But somehow, I think it's not always appreciated that there is a communication between infrared and ultraviolet. That's what's really happening in this anomaly. That's a very subtle effect. And so that's the lesson we want to bring over into four dimensions. Yeah.
The low energy Lagrangian also include every other allowed term, including this field chi. I mean, that I would have written down if I had started.
Well, if you start trying to, I mean, you have to think carefully about that because the anomaly is supposed to be an exact result protected by topology. And so it satisfies some water identities. And you can't just add any term that would mangle those water identities. So you're constrained by the modified water identities of the anomalous theory. But modulo that, yes, you should think about adding other terms. But here, in this case, it's just an exact result. Yeah.
Colin,
yeah.
You use functional integral methods.
That's what I did. Yeah.
You get started choosing the measure.
Yeah.
And you get the same answer.
Get the same answer. Yeah. Okay. So there can be, that's the theme here. There's a macroscopic effect of what might have been thought of as short distance physics. If you started thinking in terms of regularizations and ultraviolet divergences, then it looks like some very esoteric short distance ultraviolet effect, but it leads to this macroscopic effect, and clearly an effect of boson degree of freedom in the low energy effect of Lagrangian. Okay, so let's try to get.
You can have anomalies in series that have no UV divergences at all. It has nothing to do with the UV.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, so by thinking about it in this dispersive approach and the sum rule, that makes it more clear that it's UV protected somehow.
Even in just non relativistic quantum mechanics, you can have anomalies and there are no UV divergences.
Good. Yes. But presupposition, I think, in the high energy community, that anomalies are short distance physics, and you see why you can get confused because if 1/k² is and if I did Euclidean field theory, 1/k² is a point, okay, and so if I look at this in position space, it has to do with the short distance, x. The current being defined at x bilinear, so I have to separate the points, and it looks like a very delicate short distance term that I'm worried about. But of course, when I go to Lorentzian, that becomes a light cone, and so that can be also infrared. All right, let's go to 4 dimensions. So the calculations in 4 dimensions are a little bit more complicated, but essentially, in spirit, they're the same. And the difference is also, well, what are the differences? First of all, you have to look at a more complicated graph, the triangle graph, and you can easily convince yourself why that's true, because just by counting dimensions, the chiral current, the divergence of the chiral current must be dimension 4. So if I'm going to get anything on the right-hand side, it has to be a dimension 4 operator. If I try to build that out of gauge fields, I need at least 2. If I have 2 gauge fields, I must have 2 currents. When I vary this twice with respect to the background. So if I look non-background at A equals 0, I have to take 2 variations of this, which means I have to have a triangle graph with 2 currents and 1 J mu 5. That's one way of looking at it. Another way another point is that, of course, now there are other terms, whereas in 2 dimensions, this was the whole answer, because there isn't anything else. The kinematics is so simple. In higher dimensions, there are extra bits, and you have to focus on the right tensor structure in order to see it. It's only a subset of all the possible diagrams, but of all the possible terms that can arise. But here is the expression for the anomalous part. Again, it's the same story. You have some kind of Feynman amplitude that you have to define, in this case anyway, you have to define it by some regularization procedure, but you can also, as I think Dolgov pointed out long ago in the 70s, you can also look at the imaginary part, the same kind of argument I used before, and construct the full amplitude from the imaginary part, a dispersion relation, and demanding the low energy symmetries. However you do it, the result is this, that you have a non-zero divergence, k mu is coming in here, of this amplitude, which now has three indices. And if I call these p and q, I get this structure on the right-hand side, which is just the Fourier transform of f dual. Okay, and if I again play this trick of putting in a mass, you see you get two terms. This term, which goes to zero with m going to zero, is what you might call the non-anomalous term. You don't expect to get current conservation if you have a mass. And this is the term you would expect to get, but you get another finite bit. So that if you put m to zero, if you put m to zero, you get this finite anomalous divergence, which is this well-known coefficient. If you take m to infinity, on the other hand, you cancel, this term cancels that, which is just a statement of decoupling. So everything makes sense, right? If I have a very heavy field running around here, I can't see anything from this loop, and the whole term goes away. So that's how the mass enters into this discussion. So again, there's extra pieces, but because this is a non-zero effect, A is just a number coming from this diagram. But you see, if I now decompose this into tensor amplitudes and demand Lorentz invariants, again, using the vectors and epsilon symbol at my disposal in four dimensions, then you can show that there's a transverse part, which has no divergence. K mu on this is zero. But the divergent part must have a 1 over k squared, because when I contract this with k mu, I get something that's finite. So the anomaly is basically the residue of this pole. That's one way to look at it. So again, the corresponding imaginary part has a delta function. And now you can ask, OK, in four dimensions, how do I understand this? Well, again, basically, there's a corner of phase space. It's not the whole story, because there's three dimensions in which these fields can propagate. But there is a corner of phase space in which the massless fermions propagate collinearly with opposite helicities and describe a spin zero scalar, again, a relativistic Cooper pair. And you can again write down an effective action for this, in which I couple to an external chiral potential. And so this is exactly what I need to do to generate the anomalous divergence. And you can write this in terms of a set of local fields again.
Sorry, what is this A5?
So A5 is a chiral potential. It's a coupling to the chiral current.
To the chiral current.
Right. So if I added to the original fermion action a term like this, then the variation with respect, just by hand, add an external chiral potential, so that when I vary with respect to it, it gives me the current, and the divergence of that current is the anomaly. Okay, so the calculations are a little bit more complicated. This is off diagonal, right? Because there's an a mu 5 here, and there's FF dual on the other side. So naively, you need two fields, and you can't write this in terms of a single scalar unless you complete the square, but you can write in terms of two fields. But the arithmetic is very similar in this sector.
I mean, this equal is, of course, modulo terms that are invariant.
Yes, right. So this is only the anomalous part of the action. I'm generating this term, and of course, there's all kinds of other stuff, which in four dimensions, you know, is. In two dimensions, there wasn't anything else. Okay, in four dimensions, there's a lot of other stuff. And so you just have to pick out the right part and look at that subsector. Okay, so back in 2009, we actually wrote down this form of the action. And we just by hand introduced two fields called eta and chi, so that when I vary with respect to eta, I get box chi equals FF dual, and d mu chi is the chiral current. So this is essentially a bosonization in 3+1 dimensions instead of 4. And what we recently realized is that if I just add a density of chiral charge here, chiral charge density, then this actually has a hydrodynamic description. So in recent years, you may know there's been some activity. Damson and others have talked about anomalous hydrodynamics, and people in the nuclear physics heavy ion community are trying to apply that to heavy ion collisions and whether you can see effects associated with the anomaly in QCD. And so there's been some work on hydrodynamic interpretations. And so we noticed that if we just add this extra term, which is not required by the anomaly, but which should be there in thermodynamic equilibrium, then this action, this part of it we had written down in 09, actually describes ideal chiral fluid hydrodynamics. So that's what I was going to...
N5 is the number density?
The number density of chiral... Right. Of chiral...
Of chiral fermion.
Chiral charge, right. Okay. So
right.
Psi bar gamma 0 gamma 5 psi integrated. Well, this is the number density.
Eta looks like an axiom here.
Yeah.
Is it related?
Yeah. So that's axiom. Well, this is not the axion, but this is an axion-like collective excitation.
How does it play with the usual?
Yeah. Okay. So we can't. I'm just going to end on this stuff. I think we won't get to gravity until tomorrow. But this is what we've been looking at in the last few months. So this is amusing. Maybe it's a little bit tangential to the main subject here because we want to go towards gravity. But I think it's very amusing and potentially important phenomenologically, both for axions and also condensed matter applications, that you can really regard this as a fluid. This analogy that I was making with a Cooper pairing and superfluidity actually can be made precise by just adding this extra term, because in the fluid literature, people talk about Clebsch potentials, which means that the fluid velocity is written as in terms of some potentials, and if you have just a simple gradient, that means you basically have a superfluid. So if you identify this, there's no entropy, in other words, in this fluid. If you identify the gradient of eta with the chemical potential, and mu lambda is the four velocity of the fluid, and this is the chiral density, as I said, and again, the four velocity. Mu five is related to the energy density just by a thermodynamic relation. Then you can write this action that I just had in a Hamiltonian form. You can write the canonical momentum. So there's actually one pair. What happens is, well, we had two different fields and we didn't know how to connect them back in 09. But if I add this term, then they actually are connected through the mu5, because now the two are related by these relations. And then you describe a chiralon or some kind of chiral dynamic excitation in a chiral fluid. There's a Hamiltonian. You can write the Hamiltonian equations. There's usual thermodynamic relations. There's no entropy here, you see. This is all in zero temperature. Write the Hamilton equations. As Hamiltonian, it's non-dissipative. It's an ideal fluid. And now you can interpret this massless or gapless excitation as a chiral density wave, either in terms of chi or in terms of eta. And it's sourced by the anomaly. So this is potentially interesting for condensed matter applications. And as Laurent already mentioned, it naturally suggests if we can take the limit down to the vacuum, where I take N5 and mu5 towards zero, then this describes a wave not on the Fermi surface, but on the Dirac sea itself in the vacuum. So.
You've neglected vorticity in the field?
Yeah, that's basically what's happened, is because well, it's in this sector. The point is if I restrict myself to this anomalous action, I have no room for vorticity,
right,
here. Okay. So if I'm trying to do phenomenology, I could add extra terms that describe vorticity, that describe dissipation, and that means that there would be more terms, there'd be more complicated relationships between. But if I just take this action in this as it is, then it's describing a irrotational a fluid in which the velocity is basically a pure gradient.
And things move at the speed of light. Those excitations move at the speed
of light. Yeah, I mean here of course I'm doing quantum field theory, so it's speed of light, but it's
moves at the speed of light.
Right. I could write this down also in which this is some other speed there. I mean, if I were doing phenomenology, but we were coming at it from the quantum field theory and the anomaly. So,
but your formula for chi here doesn't, if I set n 5 to 0, it looks like chi is 0.
Well, there's a.
What's wrong with that argument? I mean, u and u is normalized to 1.
Yeah, u and u is normalized to 1. So.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
You'll never invite me to talk again.
it turns out if you do this in 2D, then n5 over mu 5 is just 1 over pi, so you get back to the Schwinger model. So you can put free fermions, basically if you consider free fermions of fermion density, then in 2D epsilon is going like epsilon is going like mu 5 squared, and n5 is going like mu 5, okay, and just the simple factor of pi between them, and so the result is that that the ratio of these two is. See what this is telling you is that d mu chi plus n5 over mu 5 d mu eta is equal to 0. Okay, so if this ratio is finite, then they need not, then they're related to each other and they're not, and neither is 0.
Right, I see.
Okay.
Maybe another way to see that is, in your case, chi and eta are conjugated pair.
Yeah.
So you can't put both of them to 0.
You can't put both of them to 0. Right. It could come back to those current commutators.
It's exactly.
Yeah, it's the same argument.
It's really
right.
Your Heisenberg algebra there.
Right. Right. Good. Okay. So you can recover some of the effects that people have been talking about in the literature. So notice if I vary that action with respect to the gauge potential, I get a current. The current is now proportional to the derivative of eta. And so, for example, the current density, the charge density, is b dot grad of eta, which means that if I go to, and the current is this, so it means if I go to the rest frame of a fluid and a constant magnetic field, this term is 0, the grad is 0, and here's your 0 mode, eta dot, is proportional to the background, mu 5. So you just trivially recover what's called in the literature the chiral magnetic effect, namely in a magnetic field and the presence of an imbalance in chiral densities, you must get a current. Okay, this is an interesting collective effect. If you have a magnetic field which is aligning spins, and you also put a chiral density, a background chiral density, what that means is the spins are correlated with the momentum of the particles. And so if I have both the magnetic field aligning the spins and a background density aligning it with the momenta, it means I get an overall current. Okay, that's what that's telling you. And that's interesting for many applications, both in condensed matter and early universe, particularly if you have plasmas which have chiral densities, then you might actually generate these currents. And there are many papers on this that I won't go into. There's also a chiral separation effect, corresponding effect with an ordinary charge density. Here's the relation which I wrote there. Okay, so let's not dwell on this anymore. This is your point, Laurent, that the from the Hamiltonian, the eta, the momentum conjugate to eta, because there's this mixed d eta d chi term, the momentum conjugate to eta is actually chi dot. And so this is the canonical bracket that you must get. And this is independent of any n5 or mu5. So no matter what background charge density I have, I must have a propagating mode. And of course, we knew that because we started from the anomaly, and that was in the vacuum. Okay, but what this tells me, what these considerations tell me, is that if I do have a background and I'm near thermodynamic equilibrium, then I get a bunch of other interesting effects associated with the anomaly. Again, it's macroscopic, right? I can have, this can be present over magnetic fields, this can be present over very large distances. So there's partial bosonization in 3+1 dimensions. If you put this in a magnetic field, this actually reduces to the 2D anomaly. I don't need to dwell on that. You get back the commutators. I've already said that, I think. And you can also see it by going to a particular kinematic limit of the triangle diagram itself, and it actually just reduces to the 2D case. I won't worry about that. Now, one should pause here a little bit also, because we have this massless mode, and from the hydrodynamic viewpoint, this is a gapless mode, and therefore there should be some symmetry. Or, I mean, how do we understand this in terms of symmetry? So normally you would say that you have a spontaneous breaking of symmetry, which produces a Nambo-Goldstone mode, and that's gapless. However, here we have an explicit breaking of symmetry, if you wish, from the anomaly. Nevertheless, it has a lot of the same features. And you can understand what's going on in terms of the commutators, that if I do a phase rotation of eta by a chiral phase, then in fact all the terms, higher order terms in theta vanish, and this is just a shift in theta. So in other words, you do again have a kind of shift symmetry which protects this mode and makes it massless. The single velocity potential, another way, I'm kind of maybe getting off the point here, but let me try. Yeah, if you look at this kind of term, you see FF dual, this is related to the topological character of this, because FF dual is a total derivative. So I could, in fact, do an integration by parts and flip the derivative on here, and then I would have a phase symmetry eta shifting by just a constant. So that is why, that is not exactly the Goldstone theorem, but it's quite close in spirit to it. So that even though the symmetry is broken by the anomaly, there remains a part of it which looks like a spontaneous breaking in this background. And so that's, I think, also interesting. There's another way, if you wish, to realize Goldstone's idea. Yeah.
Because you've been there since the beginning, it's clear. What you just say here seems like the story you're telling should be parallel to the story about the soft mode, which is exactly what's happening. People are discovering that there's a new type of symmetry in massless gauge, which affect like the vacua, like the n zero. So I know you started from the anomaly, but it looks like this is in some sense
they're connected.
Symmetry is exactly. It's not exactly Goldstone. It's what people call this asymptotic symmetry group, or it's part of this asymptotic symmetry group, presumably.
Yeah. So I call it Goldstone like.
Yeah,
it doesn't follow from Goldstone.
It's a new form of that people are struggling to understand properly.
Right.
But it would be okay.
Yeah. So there's much more to do here. I'm just.
The connection seems really clear, and also the UV infrared mixing. I don't think anybody has really connected your story to the softmode story, but it seems clear that this is kind of the discovery.
It's another thread in this.
It's another chapter.
I mean, I had not appreciated until Andre Sadoviev is a postdoc at Los Alamos, and I had not appreciated until he came and we started talking about the hydro side of things, that this action actually described this kind of soft mode, which you could understand in a fluid-like language. Okay, so That's what we're writing up now. There's much more to do here. I'm just touching on this. It's a little bit tangential, maybe, to the whole story, but since there are...
Can you say a little more about in vacuum? So there is this mode.
Yeah.
In vacuum.
Yeah.
And...
What does it do? And how, So we've been a little bit tenuous, but you know, we're thinking about this to actually. I mean, this looks like an axion, right? Because it has a coupling to E dot B or FF dual, which is just electromagnetic in character. It came from that triangle, but this went through too quickly, perhaps. You know, these fields are not. Are not normalized in the usual way, because in fact FF dual is dimension 4, so eta has to be dimension less, and if eta is dimension less, then chi has to have dimension 2. So they're kind of this conjugate pair is different than an axion, because there's some scale that you need to compare them to in order to talk about this, and that of course in the fluid language is provided by n5 and mu5. And now the question is, how do we make sense of that in the vacuum limit? And the mode is still there, to be sure. The question is, what does it do? And so usually in the axion story, you have a dimension 1 canonically not normalized field, and you have a coupling, which is 1 over the mass. Here you have a dimension less thing, but we still have a dimension 2 field, which is propagating, because this is the anomaly equation. So they have non-canonical dimensionality. So the effective G must be determined dynamically by the solution. It's not a parameter of the theory. It's a parameter of the background or what application you're applying it to. So yes, John. Yes. Can I finish my story and then you can?
No.
No. Okay. Okay.
In the style of the electric wave theory, it's the vacuum that's spontaneously symmetrical.
Right.
Not the Lagrange.
Right.
It's your 2 cross your 1.
Right.
So you have to have this happen here. It's the vacuum that's important. Okay, I've made my comment. Please continue.
Yeah, I mean that's parentheses to what we were saying before, that in the normal Goldstone theorem, you have a symmetric Lagrangian, and you break the symmetry only by the vacuum state.
Right.
Here, we have a symmetry that's broken in the Lagrangian, but in a very subtle way by an anomalous effect that also leads to a massless mode and also some kind of Nambu-Goldstone-like theorem. So they're physically somehow very closely related, although they look quite different. And it's an interesting story, because I actually believe in studying Schwinger's papers that that's the direction he was moving just before the Higgs. And he was trying to do all of this without introducing a scalar field and spontaneous symmetry breaking. And I think that's mind reading. But I think that's where he was going with the Schwinger model and why he was looking at all these things. But it never quite materialized. And maybe now we're a little bit better off in understanding. So I wasn't going to, I mean, this is still work in progress. We're still thinking about, obviously there are a lot of caveats, because all of this works for massless fields. Now you have to think about what happens with mass. You have to think about if this is a correlated electron state really moving through the medium in, for example, cosmological distances. Can it be decohered? It's going to interact with intermediate fields. How far does it really propagate in the presence of realistic interactions? And that's what's causing me some hesitation to making a statement that this is, really and truly an axion. But in this limit, it is. Okay? Yeah.
These fermions decouple, and in QCD we know that there's like a turnover energy scale with the SEM. So we know that the heavy quarks are not participating in spontaneously breaking at the lowest one. The lighter ones are affected by these effects. But in QED, what kind of would you expect a turnover scale?
Yeah, I mean here you have just the energy compared to the mass. So if you go back and look at, it's not fixed. There's no spontaneous symmetry breaking in the vacuum. So it's just controlled by the external parameters of your. So for example, one can think about applying this to very high energy gamma rays, TVs, where the energies are much bigger than the masses, and then the massless limit should be applicable, and then you could have this axion-like excitation. The thing I'm trying to pin down, happy to discuss with people more, is exactly how to control the interactions in the intergalactic medium. You know, what assumptions should we make about magnetic fields and so on, and whether or not this two-particle excitation decoheres and doesn't propagate over long distances. But if it does, then it's going to look and smell like an axion. And of course, it would be very interesting if we can get axions without putting in axions. But that's still work in progress, and we can talk about it. So let me just summarize this. It's already an hour and 15 minutes. The axial anomaly implies the existence of a fermion pair, which is axion-like. There's interesting connections to condensed matter and quantum fluid descriptions. By the way, this was generalized, to general relativity also by Schütz's work in the early 70s. So it fits into to basically fluid description and GR as well. We can get the chiral density wave, which is analogous to Nambu-Goldstone boson. The mixing that we've been talking about is determined dynamically through this ratio of N5 over mu 5 rather than a fixed axion parameter. So therefore, you can't just take over exactly the axion calculations, but it looks like there should be similar effects. And that's what we've been thinking about, gamma rays from extragalactic sources. Of course, this would be wonderful to apply to QCD as well, but then you have strong interactions to worry about and other effects, so which we can also talk about. Andre is interested in the quark-gluon plasma, so we've been thinking about that. Magnetic fields in neutron stars and plasma instabilities coming from these chiral magnetic effects. There are possible applications to Dirac and Weil semi-metals in condensed matter. And I think it's, for me, interesting that there's some fundamental field theory derivation of hydrodynamics. I mean, usually you have to, you're very distant. Hydrodynamics is very distant from the microscopic description. You have to go through many steps to get an effective hydro description. But here, at least in this very special limit, you have a kind of ideal quantum superfluid. And it does suggest, right, that the vacuum itself is that kind of a superfluid. I mean, so, there you can speculate. So where I want to go with all this, and I think the purpose of the talks for the folks here is to apply all of this to the conformal anomaly and to gravity. And I mean, I think it's too late to start. I was going to let this go where it goes and get to it if you want to, but I think we should stop here and continue with discussion and pick up the gravitational story tomorrow. Okay? Thank you.
QCD would expect these effects to be to vanish on scales bigger than the inverse quark masses.
It's not clear what the scale in QCD is. I mean, because, if there
would it
be the QCD scale? I mean, presumably the lambda QCD is going.
So that's the question.
Yeah. How do you then write that effective field theory and match to lower scales? I mean, there should be, this has hardly been discussed. There should be an anomaly in the pion effect of Lagrangian as well,
right.
And you should be able to do. Just like you do the chiral anomaly matching, you ought to be able to do the conformal anomaly matching there. So that's important for tomorrow because how to get numbers out. I mean, in order to take these ideas and actually predict something, say for gravitational waves or the other experiments, it's very important to understand how that interplay of scales really works in QCD. But so this was just the pictures that I left out about the possible.
So what is the effect exactly? This gamma ray comes.
Yeah. So this has been discussed largely in terms of axions.
Right.
Is that if you have very high energy gamma rays coming from a distant cosmological source, if there were no axion, there would be various absorptive processes, extragalactic background light, CMB photons, stray magnetic fields, and that's been estimated and would expect it to cut off the high energy spectrum.
Yeah.
So with people like at Los Alamos, the Hawk experiment, high altitude Cherenkov observatory in Hess and similar, are now sensitive to these high energy TV gamma rays. And if they see any sources in this energy spectrum where you know something about the energy output and you see this, you actually see the high energy gamma rays getting here, then that's telling you that either you don't understand the absorption mechanisms or it's mixing with some other field. So there have been speculations in the literature that if you mixed with an axion, that would help the photon get through. And you know, it's the data is poor, and you can't make any statement yet. But this is the kind of it's an experimentalist at Los Alamos. This is they actually took some axion model and if you go above these TV gamma rays,
right,
then the question is, do you see anything out here? Or this is what you expect to see. And so far, the data is consistent with this. There are a few events with outliers, you know, nothing to get excited about yet. But if you see a few clear events out here, you know, this is a log scale. So if you see a few events out here, it's telling you there's something else going on, either in the intergalactic medium or there's some extra light field. So as you know, there are a lot of discussions now about ultralight fields and whether there's something hiding beyond the standard model. Yeah.
After much effort, no one's been able to detect sort of scale of actual vector particle, so-called axions. So do you expect to detect this particle physically?
Well, this is an indirect detection. If you
this is in QED.
This is in QED.
Energy is well above the electron.
Well above the electron mass.
It's a completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, the axion detections are all at very
low. Yeah,
right.
Very
so he's not saying there's any effect.
Right.
No,
I mean, you know, the electron mass is light by most particle physics, but for axions and other searches, you know, it's still MEVs. So you have to you have to get above that scale. You certainly can't apply these massless considerations. So and the other thing that we're trying to do is systematically include the mass and see how that affects things. And for certainly what it's going to do, I mean, from that slide I showed somewhat back, if you have a mass because of the decoupling, it means that unless the energies are comparable to or higher than the mass, there's no effect at all. I mean, you just suppress the whole anomaly. Okay, so you have to get above those energies. But then the question is, can you actually calculate those mass effects in a consistent way?
You should see in a lab experiment somewhere.
Somewhere, yes. Yeah. I agree.
If you don't, then this is important.
Yeah. Yeah. Because unlike axion physics, right, where it's motivated by QCD, but you have scales to play with. Here, you know, it's standard model physics. So either we're doing it right or we're doing it wrong. And if we're not, if we have actual effects that are not there, then it's also telling us something interesting. Yeah. So this has to be there, I think. But exactly because it's a collective mode and susceptible to being decohered by many different processes and suppressed. I don't have right now, I'm still working on this, I don't have right now, a quantitative prediction for you.
What do you think it's going to be?
Well, it's a worry, right? Because it's a pair excitation.
Sure.
So you know, it's just like superconductivity. You know, if you raise the temperature, you break up the pairs, and eventually you don't see that excitation anymore. And we don't have complete control to do that calculation yet.
So you can't do it at finite temperature.
Yeah, finite temperature, you add terms, and there's, you know, it's very complicated. The question is, at what temperature does the effect go away? And have I really taken into account all the interactions that could break the pairs apart? And this is a subject which we're debating. I was hoping to finish this paper before I came here, but we're still debating.
That's the one on the fluids.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why that's
your best guess.
Well, I'm optimistic that there's an effect that can be seen somewhere, but you know, before we go out on a limb, I want to be sure that I have all.
What is the temperature?
What is the temperature? What are the scales? Can there be? And I'd be happy to discuss this more. I mean, this is ongoing. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So, where are you looking for these effects? Like, if you say that this universally affects all fermions that are charged on QD, then effects like quarks and Do you expect something in pion scattering lengths or anything in electron-positron?
Well, you know, in QCD, I skipped the QCD part because it's more complicated, but you know, this mode is in QCD, except it gets massive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically the eta prime meson.
Yeah.
It gets swallowed. I mean, you know, if you put in the interactions, this is an old story going back, you know, to Veneziano and DeVecchio and Witten and those people back in the early 80s. But then, but this mode is there, but it becomes strongly interacting and massive. Okay, and then the question is there anything else left over which is axion-like? And I don't know yet. Okay, so I'm just telling you, I'm right up at.
That old story has nothing to do with the quark masses. It's just QCD.
Well. Which whole story? The
eta prime.
Yeah. The quark masses can essentially be ignored in that story. I mean, they're there, but they don't. They barely affect what's going on. Yeah. It's basically the story. There is a chiral susceptibility that the QCD vacuum has a chiral susceptibility. So there's an extra term, which you have to add by hand, and that gives you a relation between the eta prime mass and the and the chiral susceptibility. And back in the 80s, that was seemed like a reasonable thing, but now it's been measured on the lattice, and it's pretty true. This, you know, I don't know, I think it was Veneziano who first did it, but it's usually called Witten-Veneziano relation or something. And that's what happens to this field in that case. So that's that's understood in pure QCD. But then we have electromagnetic interactions in QCD. And should there not be an axion-like mode there? I shouldn't say more until I understand better, okay? Because I'm only going to my step in it. I just don't know yet. I mean, this is relatively new. We actually did the conformal. It's kind of interesting. We actually did the conformal anomaly because my focus was on gravity, on black holes, on cosmology, and on gravitational waves, which I'm going to get to tomorrow. But then you realize that all these effects should be there in the chiral anomaly, and then go back and look more carefully at the chiral anomaly, and particularly now with the interest in axion-like particles. Let's talk about this some more. I'm still working on it. Hope this was understandable. Okay. Thank you.
Good.